Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten. Mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnet? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto. Das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall.
Donald Trump is a genuine threat to this nation. He's a threat to our freedom. He's a threat to our democracy. He's literally a threat for everything America stands for.
And that was President Biden speaking a few hours ago, vigorous, coherent, defiant, addressing a campaign rally in the US state of North Carolina. But it was his faltering performance in last night's TV debate with Donald Trump that is causing some Democrats to ask whether he should continue as the party's candidate in November's election. There have long been questions about whether the 81-year-old Mr. Biden has the mental and physical stamina to serve a second term, but they were brought into sharp focus during the 90-minute bad-tempered and personal debate, which was marked by Mr. Trump making a string of false or misleading claims, and President Biden sounding hoarse for much of the time. Speaking to NewsHour earlier, the chair of the Democratic National Committee, Jamie Harrison, defended the president's record and said he would remain as the Democratic Party's nominee.
The president has been doing this work for a long time. He understands what he did well last night and what he didn't do well. But ultimately, again, a presidency is not defined by 90 minutes on television. A presidency is defined by the work that you do. That's why you go to the polls to elect a president, to get stuff done. And you can't tell me that there's been a president in my lifetime, I know, that has gotten more done with less than Joe Biden. I mean, he has delivered time and time again, and he will continue to deliver moving forward.
However, there was a slightly different perspective from these Democratic voters who watched the Biden-Trump TV debate in Washington.
It was tragic. I had my hopes that Biden would make a good showing, and I support Biden. And now I don't know what to think. I don't know if he's suitable to be running, and I know Donald Trump isn't suitable to be running. So I feel this country is in a real tragic state. And I'm 75 years old. I have voted in every election, and I always knew who I was going to vote for. Now, I don't know what to do, and I'm quite scared.
It was kind of clear to me that maybe Biden's not as with it as he used to be, and I think I'd be supportive if someone, they put up another candidate rather than Biden. But I think Biden is good on the issues. I just think he has had a hard time communicating them. And I think Trump is horrible on the issues, but had an easier time communicating them. So that is what worries me, that Trump communicated lies better than Biden communicated the truth.
Democratic voters in Washington. And I spoke earlier before Mr. Biden's campaign rally to Christine Pelosi, an American Democratic Party political strategist from California. Also, the daughter of Nancy Pelosi, the former Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. Where does she stand in the argument about whether to keep Joe Biden as a presidential candidate or ask him to step aside?
I stand with Joe Biden. As someone who's been a Democratic National Committee member since I was a young Democrat, since 1996, I've heard this for years when things get rough. In 2010, it was Obama should step down for Clinton. In 2012, Obama flubbed his first debate, and we thought all was lost against Romney. In 2016, it was Hillary's overprepared. In 2018, it was Nancy Pelosi's too old to be speaker. In 2020, it was Biden can't beat Trump. In 2022, it was John Fetterman had a stroke, and we have to replace him, if Pennsylvania senator. And now, last night, with Biden having both a cold and a stutter combined, it's a bad debate performance, and people say he should step down. I'm not comfortable canceling the votes of millions of Americans across the country for one bad performance. I do think the president ought to go out and do unscripted interviews to show, not tell, but show the American people what those of us who have seen him up close behind the scenes for months have seen and already know, which is that he is has a great vision for the future, and he's more than capable of being our standard bearer and a nominee for 2024. For those who are suggesting their favorite person for president, respectfully, that's a conversation for 2028.
So you would explain away his faltering performance last night as a
I wouldn't explain it away. As, I think
no, but you've just said he had a cold and he had a stutter. That was your way of explaining it. I appreciate that. So you wouldn't go into the area of a loss of cognitive ability.
Oh no, frankly, I don't see that in either candidate. Donald Trump got up there and lied very, very comfortably, lost his train of thought, didn't answer questions, and got back to the lies he wanted to tell. Obviously, most offensively, that my own mother would plan her own assassination. Ridiculous. I don't ascribe that to a lack of cognitive ability. I think that these are two old men. If we're looking at a rematch of grumpy old men, I think the advantage goes to Trump. And certainly it did.
But Mr. Biden came over last night as being somewhat frail, a frail 81-year-old who will be 85 should he become president and last his term. Is it really fair to put him through 4 years of what is a physically and mentally demanding job?
I think Joe Biden has the vision for the country that we need. He's proven to be the only person who's able to beat Donald Trump. And he right now has earned the confidence and the respect of millions of Americans who just renominated him for president in their respective states. It's really important, I think, for folks to understand, we know that we have two older gentlemen who are running for president. And we're also quite aware that knowing that, voters in both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party have chosen to nominate them over other younger candidates. So I think that in this day and age, subject to the best health care in the world, either the former president or the current president will be more than physically capable of doing the job.
Well, let's go back to the cold and the stutter. Would you accept that there were times during that debate when Mr. Biden sounded incoherent?
That's what happens when you have a stutter, actually. You stutter and you block. I knew what he meant on some of these policy issues because I know them. And that is why I think he should have more interviews, not less, more of these unscripted moments, not less, to show people that, yeah, he had a bad night. The fact is, of course, it was a bad performance. I don't know how, I don't sugarcoat that. I don't spin that. When Bill Clinton gave a horrible, long speech in 1988 at the Democratic National Convention, and I was a volunteer backstage when it happened. It was even worse in person than it seemed like on TV. He knew he had to get out there and show people that he was in command of the facts. And he went out and did interviews and TV. And 4 years later, he was elected president of the United States. But that night, you would have said, that guy's career is over. What's he even doing on the national stage? That's all you can do when you fall. You have to pick yourself back up. Otherwise, all people are going to remember is the fall.
That was Christine Pelosi, an American Democratic Party political strategist. Well, a few hours ago, as I've already mentioned, President Biden was back on the campaign trail in North Carolina, a state that Democrats consider pivotal in November's election. He sounded and looked reinvigorated as he delivered his set speech and referenced his performance in the debate last night.
Oops. I don't walk as easy as I used to. I don't speak as smoothly as I used to. I don't debate as well as I used to. But I know what I do know. I know how to tell the truth. I know right from wrong. And I know how to do this job.
The BBC's Nomia Iqbal was at the rally in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I put it to her that a scripted speech, a teleprompter, and an adoring crowd make a lot of difference.
Makes a huge difference. I mean, you'd almost be forgiven for looking at President Biden's performance and thinking, is that an entirely different man? Because he was everything that his critics accused him of not being last night. He was sharp, he was energetic, he was passionate, he was peppy, he was cracking jokes. And he was laying out clearly what he thought was the threats from Donald Trump. But as you rightly said there, it was in a situation that was very different to last night. There was a teleprompter. He was surrounded by really adoring fans, people shouting at him, saying, four more years, let's go, Joe, lock him up, in reference to Donald Trump, who made that slogan infamous during the time when he was running against Hillary Clinton. And so for Biden, that will be seen as a look at me, I can do this. And that's essentially what he was saying in the speech tonight. He addressed the debate failure straight on, saying, look, I'm, you know, not a young guy, but I know my right from wrong. And he made it very clear he's not going anywhere.
Joe Biden came on before the president himself. What are we to make of that? Does that often happen?
It was interesting because she really sort of rallied the crowd. And, you know, you have moments where the First Lady does do that. We didn't see it much with Donald Trump when he was president, with Melania Trump. But I think that was also a sign from Dr. Jill Biden that Joe Biden is going nowhere either. I mean, there's all this talk at the moment about him coming off the ticket, and there's so many technical reasons and legal reasons why that might be difficult without getting too much into the weeds. But I think the general view is that he has to want to come off the ticket. He has to stand down for that to happen, and there are people around him who could convince him to do that. Could that be his wife? Could it be the First Lady? Well, judging from, you know, the way she spoke about him at the start, the way she supported him and got the crowd going, no, you know, she's very much standing shoulder to shoulder with her husband, and said quite clearly that she would want no other man in the Oval Office.
That was the BBC's Nomia Iqbal in North Carolina. Coming up, we speak to Academy Award winner Russell Crowe on his way to perform at Glastonbury Music Festival on why music is his first love.
Well, it's more like a reset for me, man, because this is how I started. And I've been making feature films for 35 years now, but music predated the movies by a long, long way, you know.
More of that interview later in this edition of NewsHour. The latest headlines from the BBC newsroom: a defiant Joe Biden has told supporters in North Carolina he intends to win November's election, a day after his faltering display in a televised debate raised questions about his candidacy. And the US Supreme Court has reached a potentially far-reaching decision which weakens the power of federal agencies to regulate areas such as public health and the environment. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. Voting has been extended in Iran's presidential election, in which four candidates are vying to replace Ibrahim Raisi, who was killed in a helicopter crash in May. They've all been vetted by Iran's powerful Guardian Council and are all loyal to the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. But the election is unusually competitive, since the candidates include a cleric, a conservative, an ultra-conservative, and a reformist, Masoud Pezeshkian, who could potentially boost turnout in a country where there's growing voter apathy. These women from Tehran share their views on the election with NewsHour.
I know it's national duty. I should vote, but I won't. For 45 years, the Islamic Republic has put its own interests ahead of the needs of 80 million who deserve better. Reformists, conservatives, they are all the same. They have done nothing to save people from a sanctioned, crippling economy.
I would be voting for Mr. Pezeshkian. I believe that change can only come from inside Iran and through reform. Pezeshkian seems clean. I mean, there are no allegations of corruption against him. He also wants to improve women's rights, and he also wants to improve Iran's relations with the outside world and work on lifting the sanctions.
We'll hear now from Nasser Hadian, professor of politics at Tehran University. How does today's turnout so far compare to the parliamentary elections back in March, a record low?
It's going to be certainly better than that. Because of the national level, if I'm not mistaken, the last parliamentary election was about 41%. And already today, we have passed 44%.
And how would you explain that increased percentage?
The competition, because before that, there was basically not serious, genuine competition. And so the people, many decided not to participate. In fact, that's even the case today. Because after all, yes, we have a choice. We have a choice which is different from the others. But still, there are many others who have been qualified, but they have been disqualified to run. But this time, comparing with the previous presidential election, we have a choice, as simple as that. So once you have a choice, so many people would decide to participate and to choose the one they think would serve their interest better, would serve the country better. So that's why we see the increase in rate of participation. Still, there are many, many others who are not convinced or persuaded to participate. They think the choices are not good enough. And also, they believe that by participating in the election process, they may give legitimacy to the process and to the government. So that's why they have decided not to participate.
And is that competition about which you speak, has that been reflected in the campaign?
To some extent, as you know, there was only about 15 days for competition. And particularly for the reformist candidate, there was not enough time to organize a sufficiently strong campaign. So, but I guess now, today, about 30% will not participate no matter what.
Whoever wins this presidential election, be it in the first or the second round, what would you say was the most pressing issue for that person in their entree?
I mean, let's divide it to domestic and to the international one. The domestic level, certainly containing the inflation is, I guess, the most important factor. And lowering the prices, or at least the rate of increase, which is the same thing as inflation. The fluctuation is important. The exchange rate is important. These are domestic issues which should be dealt with. Also, social issue like hijab or Islamic headscarf, these are important. Employment at the economic level are important. But internationally, it is important that someone can deal with the sanctions. And in order to deal with the sanctions, they have to do something with the JCPOA. They have to be able to deal with America first and the European second. They have to come up with a sort of agreement with them.
That was Nasser Hadian, professor of politics at Tehran University. Ukraine needs all the help it can get to push back the Russian invaders and mitigate the damage caused by Russian bombardment of Ukraine's infrastructure. Those bombardments have caused lengthy blackouts during Ukraine's summer and left many people without refrigeration. So could bees, or rather beeswax, be of assistance? UK scientists have been working with beekeepers in Ukraine, the world's largest producer of honey in Europe, to develop wax wrappings for perishable goods. Professor Les Bailey is the lead researcher on the project. He's been telling me why beeswax makes such a good preservative.
Beeswax food wraps have been used for thousands of years, so this is not a new idea. And it's been shown that by wrapping food like bread or sandwiches in these wax wrappings, you can increase the shelf life by a couple of days. And the reason for that is that beeswax contains natural antimicrobial compounds, which come from the plants that the bees visit when they're making their honey and their wax. And that beeswax helps preserve the food by killing off the nasty food-spoiling organisms.
So you've already got the technology to make these waxed wrappers, and you're experimenting with different types of Ukrainian honey.
So we've been working in Wales to create these bespoke wax wraps using Welsh honey and Welsh plants. And of course, it transpires that Ukraine is the biggest honey producer in Europe. So this started us thinking, could we share the Welsh know-how with our friends in Ukraine to help them discover their own beeswax wrap formulation?
I mean, have you been able to conclude whether Ukrainian honey makes a more effective beeswax wrapper yet?
Well, we've been able to, with the help of our friends in Ukraine, to test honey and a compound called propolis, which is bee glue. By carrying out some analysis, we've identified those types of honey and propolis from the regions of Ukraine where they're the most active, that is, the highest potential to kill food spoilage organisms.
You were originally, I understand, looking into the preservative properties of beeswax to limit single-use plastics, and you swiveled to food preservation in Ukraine.
Well, they are actually linked. If you think about it, one of the biggest uses of single-use plastic is in the wrapping of food. And of course, that means that we're dumping huge amounts of plastic into the environment. So that prompted us along the lines of, well, is there a sustainable alternative? So there was an obvious avenue there to steer away from single-use plastic, but also in the case of Ukraine to help them.
And storage of food imperiled in Ukraine at the moment because of occasional blackouts and a loss of refrigeration.
People may realise that Ukraine has very diverse climate. In the winter, it's very cold. And, of course, then food storage isn't an issue. But it's really in the hot summers. And if their neighbours have destroyed the power systems and you have nothing to power your refrigerator, there are beehives all over the country. People could go to their local beekeeper, borrow some honey, borrow some wax, and make these wraps at home. We actually shared our DIY guide to our friends in Ukraine, who then translated it into Ukrainian and shared it on social media. So there are YouTube videos of how to make this wax. It's on TikTok, it's on Facebook.
And how much uptake has there been on social media in Ukraine?
Difficult to know. My Ukrainian is not as what it should be. Several thousand hits so far, and our friends in Ukraine have run workshops. And indeed, they've even had some interest from the Ukrainian military.
Professor Les Bailey, stay with us here on NewsHour. A lot more to come.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten. Mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnet? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto. Das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
Welcome back to NewsHour. A company in the UK claims to have come up with a super-fast charging car battery, which could potentially take the anxiety out of long trips. A shortage of charging points is a particular obstacle to the mass rollout of electric cars, at least here in Britain. The BBC technology correspondent Zoe Kleinerman told my colleague Paul Henley more about this innovation.
This is a really interesting bit of battery innovation that's come from a UK firm called Niobolt. What they are looking at is one particular issue, which is how to make your electric vehicle charge more quickly. So there are super fast chargers, but in order to use those, you have to have a compatible battery. And what they have just done is tested a battery that they've spent about 5 years designing in a sports car on a real road in real world conditions. So we had a heat wave here in the UK as well. You know, there were kind of issues to contend with that were outside of the laboratory. And they found that they were able to charge this battery from 10% to 80% in 4 minutes and 37 seconds. Now, just as by way of comparison, there is currently a supercharger network that's run by Tesla, and that does about the same thing in 15 to 20 minutes, which is still quite quick. But to be able to do it in under 5 minutes is potentially a bit of a game changer, isn't it? Because it's bringing electric vehicle charging more in line time-wise with the amount of time you might perhaps expect to spend filling a traditional car with petrol or diesel.
How soon will everybody have one of these?
They've said, in theory, within the next year or 2 years, this battery could be ready to be deployed in cars that we will see on the roads. But you've got to bear in mind that it's all very well having the battery that's able to do this. But what you also need is the infrastructure around you to support that. And that means you need super fast chargers. In order for this to work well, you need to have that infrastructure as well. And there are lots of people saying, you know, one of the things that's holding people back from buying electric vehicles is this concern about, A, the amount of time it takes to charge, but B, the availability of chargers. If you can't have one at home, then you're relying on public ones.
Given that it seems to be the consensus that electric cars are the future, there must be a race to produce something like this in countries all over the world at the moment.
Oh, yes, of course there are. And you know, one of the things that you really need to make them, it's an obvious one, really, but you need battery factories. They're called gigafactories, and they're absolutely huge. There's over 100 of them in China. There's around 35 of them either in planning or in construction at the moment in the EU. And there is another one that's going into production here in the UK. But they are huge, and they also take time. They can't sort of be sprung up quickly. So while the race is on for the innovation that can make batteries better, we're back again, aren't we, to the infrastructure we need to actually make these things and to make them, as you say, in huge volume, if this is the way that transport is going.
That was the BBC's technology correspondent, Zoe Kleinman. You're with NewsHour, coming to you live from the BBC in London. And we return to our top story, President Biden's poor showing in last night's TV debate with Donald Trump. His verbal stumbles and occasional meandering responses have heightened concerns, not only among voters, but also his own party, that the 81-year-old might not be fit enough to serve another four-year term. The Republicans' presumptive candidate, Donald Trump, on the other hand, seemed energised and delivered a string of unsupported claims in his typically bombastic style. So, can we expect the Republicans to exploit Mr. Biden's poor performance in the debate? Steve Moore of the Heritage Foundation is the senior economic advisor to Donald Trump.
I think most Americans were somewhat shocked that Joe Biden did not have a good night and didn't seem like he was just mentally all there. And as you know, that's been a suspicion of a lot of people. We haven't really seen Joe Biden on the stage like that for a long time. He made some gibberish statements and things like that, and oftentimes had to say, You know, it was interesting because the people who were most concerned about that were not Republicans, but Democrats, who, after the debate was over, said, oh my gosh, we may be stuck with somebody who is a sure loser here. There's about a 50-50 chance that Joe Biden may not be the Democratic nominee come November.
And is that a worry to Republicans?
If you ask me, yes. I mean, I'm a senior economic advisor to the Trump campaign, and we want to put our agenda against his. We want to put our record against his, and we think it stacks up very well. One of the points that Donald Trump made yesterday was, you know, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And for most Americans, the answer to that question is no.
The Republicans would be concerned if Joe Biden was replaced as candidate.
If they were to go with, say, one of the Democratic governors, who's more, you know, for example, Gavin Newsom, who is the governor of California, our biggest state, he's a very charismatic guy. So we'd rather run against Joe Biden than someone like that.
Mr. Trump made a number of misleading claims. Some might even call them lies. For instance, he said at one point of Mr. Biden, he wants to raise your taxes by 4 times. And that's not accurate, is it?
No, and that's kind of typical of Trump, that he exaggerates, and you can call it a lie. I mean, you know, Biden said some pretty outrageous things too. But
such
it
as,
is true.
Such as?
Such as he keeps saying that the deficits are lower than under his presidency than Biden's. And that's not even close to being true. But in terms of this issue that you mentioned with respect to the taxes on the middle class, it is not true that he's going to increase them by 4 times. But it is true that if he cancels the Trump tax cut, which he says he will do, that would be a very large tax increase. It would be about a $2,000 a year tax increase for most middle-class families.
One commentator described the performance of the two men as Mr. Biden communicating the truth ineffectively and Donald Trump communicating lies effectively. Would you go along with that?
No, I think that more lies came out of Joe Biden's mouth than, and by the way, I don't like to even use the term lies. I mean, Trump exaggerates all the time.
What we've been discussing is a lie. He wants to raise your taxes by 4 times. Not true.
Okay. You can call it what you want. But my point is, well, here's Biden's lie. He said, I'm not going to raise taxes on people who make less than $400,000. And he is. So they both lied.
Going forward, though, would you expect Mr. Trump, who has made a lot of Mr. Biden's age before now, to do so even more?
I hope not. You know, I don't want him to, because I think it's self-evident. You know, there's no reason. It's almost elder abuse to do that. The interesting thing is they're not that far apart in age. I've been around Trump a lot. He shows no signs of slowing down either mentally or physically. The question I think a lot of Americans have to ask if Biden remains the candidate is this person, regardless of your ideology, is he up to the job?
Is Donald Trump, though, a worthy alternative?
Well, I certainly think so. I think he was one of our most successful presidents. I mean, people forget that before COVID happened, we had one of the most booming economies ever. And he has his flaws, but it's pretty clear that in terms of the handling of the economy, that's where Trump has a real advantage.
My understanding was that the U.S. economy was doing rather well at the moment.
You know, it's fair. I would describe it as fair. We have still, I mean, what you need to do if you think we have a good economy is just go to the grocery stores around here and go to the gas pump and look at people when they pay their bills. I mean, the big problem for Biden is that the average American family is about $2,000 poorer today than when Biden came into office. But the polls still show it a very close race.
That was Steve Moore of the Heritage Foundation, who is a senior economic advisor to the Trump campaign. France is about to hold the first round of an unexpected parliamentary election this weekend, with the far right widely predicted to take first place. The French president has warned that support for extreme parties on the right and left threaten to plunge the country into civil war. To gauge the public mood, our correspondent Andrew Harding has been to Brittany, long considered one of the most politically moderate corners of France.
The weather is finally gorgeous here, and the beaches of southern Brittany are filling up. The Olympics are round the corner. Surely a languid French summer beckons. Or does it? In the pretty market town of Auray, tempers are strained. Political polarisation has finally arrived in rural, famously moderate Brittany. Solène and Alain run a market stall, but when two young men walk past, campaigning for the hard-right National Rally Party, the couple seethe.
C'est le fascisme, quoi.
It's fascism, says Alain. I call a spade a spade.
On les déteste.
We hate their ideas, says Solène. We hate everything about them. One of the National Rally campaigners is a 19-year-old student, Mathis Auger. He thinks mass immigration is ruining France.
We have an identity crisis. The foreigners keep apart. They shop in their own markets. They don't speak our language. I feel that I no longer have my rightful place as a Frenchman, that I'm being forced to change.
Opinion polls here suggest that message, amplified by the media, is cutting through, and that the hard right is poised to come first this weekend in the first round of parliamentary elections, even here in sleepy Brittany. We have a history, a culture, says Armand, a retired fireman. I'm worried, he says. On the television here, a succession of increasingly shrill debates between French political camps. The left has quickly united against the hard right, but stranded between them, the centre is wobbly and shrinking. I've come along the coast now to Lorient, a big port city. Basketball practice for a group of children in a poor and overwhelmingly immigrant community. You can see the effort that's gone into helping people integrate here, with some success. But for how much longer? The polls now show this city, which used to lean communist, has now swerved towards the hard right. Watching the world go by from a nearby cafe is Saïd, a pensioner, originally from Algeria. The national rally is dangerous, he says. My wife wears the veil, but they want to ban it, so she's afraid.
Catastrophic.
If they get into power, it will be catastrophic. Back at the beach, a few bathers are braving Brittany's chilly waters. What happens in the next few weeks here is unclear. It could be political deadlock. It could be a hard right landslide, a violent reaction, constitutional upheavals. An anxious summer awaits.
Andrew Harding reporting there from Brittany in France. And we go now to the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is struggling to contain a new strain of Mpox, formerly known as monkeypox and described as the most dangerous yet, which has killed 1,000 people since the start of last year. The strain, which causes lesions across the whole body, can be passed through close skin-to-skin contact. Trudy Lang has made a number of visits to the affected areas and will be going again next month. She's Professor of Global Health at the University of Oxford.
Mpox, formerly known as monkeypox, is a virus that circulated in Africa for many decades, and it was really associated with a family bringing perhaps some bushmeat into the household and the meat being infected with this virus and it being transmitted from the bushmeat to the family members. And then it was pretty much limited to those households. Then a couple of years ago, in 2022, people might remember when Mpox appeared in Europe. And this was associated in a very different way. And this was more appearing with very close contact, person to person. So typically it was circulating in the homosexual community, men who had sex with men. But it was a similar sort of disease, but quite low mortality, thankfully, and was really cleared by use of vaccines. And so we talk about Mpox as clade 1 and clade 2. Clade 1 is the sort we've been used to circulating in Africa that's associated with bushmeat and household transmission. And then clade 2, the type we saw in Europe and the US, which was around men who had sex with men.
So what is the strain that's now being identified in the DRC?
Yes, we saw right in the far corner of DRC where it borders with Burundi and Rwanda, it presenting very differently. So this time we were seeing sexual transmission and person-to-person transmission outside the household. And in fact, no stories so far of animal involvement whatsoever. So this is all person-to-person, definitely sexual transmission. And so we assumed when we were first looking at this, this has got to be clade 2 appearing in Africa in a different way. We then sequenced it, and actually it turned out to be a variant of clade 1. So this strain we're now calling clade 1B.
What's the mortality rate of this new strain?
So everything I can report is from observational data and the measurements we've taken so far in an ongoing study. So this isn't formally analysed yet. But what I can say is that for the patients that are presenting in hospital, so those with quite severe disease, we're seeing a mortality rate of about 5% in adults and about 10% in children. And also lots of the pregnant cases that have been in, quite a high proportion of the pregnancies have been sadly lost. And so it is associated with quite a worrying level of mortality. But we don't know how much disease is circulating that isn't as severe. So it's hard to be precise on those numbers at this point.
What treatment is available for those in the Democratic Republic of Congo?
Up in this particular region, we're just using supportive therapy for these cases. There are some vaccines and drugs that are in clinical trials, and it would be really excellent to now test those products, both the drugs and the vaccines, on these cases to see if they're effective in this strain.
And those borders in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo are very porous. So I suppose there's a fairly strong likelihood that Burundi, Rwanda have been similarly affected, even though they may not have identified the disease yet.
Exactly. And I think this is what everybody's been very realistic around. The people move across the border, and that's where the roads run, the mining community. There's also trucks going backwards and forwards. And indeed, a lot of this has been transmitted by the sex industry, as is typical in these regions. And lots of the sex workers move across the borders. And indeed, there's definitely been Rwandan cases that have been identified in the DRC of Rwandan nationals who have been part of these presentations in the hospitals in DRC.
That was Professor Trudy Lang. This is Julian Marshall with News Hour Live from the BBC in London. Before he was an actor, let alone an Oscar-winning one, Russell Crowe was in a band that did regular gigs in pubs and clubs and had a recording contract. At the age of 60, Russell Crowe's career has sort of come full circle, except that the venue for his band's latest gig is one of the biggest and most celebrated in the world, Glastonbury Music Festival here in the UK. So the actor who's most famous for his roles in the massive hit films Gladiator, A Beautiful Mind and Les Miserables has returned to music. He's released a new album called Pros and Cons. His band is Indoor Garden Party. They play Glastonbury this Saturday. And my colleague Paul Henley spoke to him while he was en route to this country. About to take off from Rome Airport, he explained how the Glastonbury plan came about.
We were on the road last year for about 30 shows or whatever, and we knew we were coming back to Italy to do some shows. So I talked to Simon Brand, who's a promoter, and he did the shows the last time we played in the UK. When I talked to him about it, he said, look, funnily enough, came up in conversation the other night that they were going to ask you to play at Glastonbury. It was pretty exciting news. And then we had to sit on that information for about 7 months. We weren't allowed to discuss it or tell anybody because they do their own announcements. So that was kind of torturous. But it's really exciting. Everybody in the band's really looking forward to it.
And what can people expect at Glastonbury? How would you describe your music?
It's available to listen to if you're interested. It was called Pros and Cons, and the set at Glastonbury is going to be pretty much made up of the new album stuff because we only play for an hour. But, you know, we sort of touch into gospel, we touch into blues, we do the occasional dirty country song about murder. The majority of what we do is original material, but the thing about the album, Pros and Cons, P-R-O-S-E and Cons, there's 9 original tracks and 5 covers. So the pros being the originals and the cons being the covers.
And is being on stage and performing music a welcome break from acting? Is it harder? How does it compare?
Well, it's more like a reset for me, man, because this is how I started, you know, like 45 years ago, whatever. This is what I used to do. I used to tour with the band. I've been making feature films for 35 years now, but I've always kept my connection to music and always periodically recorded and released stuff or toured. So it's a very natural place for me, man. That's what some people find hard to understand, you know, that music predated the movies by a long, long way, you know. My first record came out in 82. And I made my first movie in 89. So, you know, there's a sort of almost a full career prior to me becoming a film actor, so to speak.
A film set's a very strict setting, isn't it? Not like being on stage.
No, you have disciplines on a film set that you have to adhere to. And obviously there's a lot of discipline involved in being on tour for 36 shows or something over a couple of months as well. But, yeah, for sure, that's the reason I get a buzz out of it, man, because the very first thing I did when I, you know, set out on a creative journey was walk on a stage and sing a song. And so, it's, as I said, it's just a very natural place for me to be on stage talking about the things that are on my mind.
But is it acting or is it just being you?
With the music, it's 100% just doing me. I'm not playing any kind of role. You asked before about work. I mean, it's an extreme amount of work when you're on a tour like this. I mean, we're only like in the first week of it, and already we're just, you know, everybody's starting to drag their heels a little bit because of the travel and the, you know, lining up for things and what have you. But that's what I get to express when I'm on a stage, you know, because there's a certain sense of anarchy. You never know, no matter what you're prepared or whatever, you walk out on stage, the audience responds a certain way. You might adjust the show around that. You know, the night always has its moments and its differences.
What about the baggage associated with being you, with being the big movie star?
One or two songs into the set, that just disappears and the whole thing changes. We do get a fair amount of ambulance chases, you know, at our gigs. People that come along and go, well, what's this all about? But, you know, you also got to keep in mind that I've been doing it for such a long time and the music's been available on the internet for such a long time that there are people that have been following everything I've done musically, so they know every word of every song. So it's definitely a combination of people in the crowd.
Even the cover of your album is your work, isn't it? Just describe it.
Well, it's a photograph of a bloke who was thinking about going for a swim in Woolloomooloo Bay in the middle of winter in Sydney. And it was quite cold that morning. And he was just stopped there and had a think. And so I took a photograph from behind him. But the way the light was refracting off the water, it's very painterly and beautiful. It just seemed to me to fit with the idea of pros and cons. I know we're using it as a play on words to do with the content of the songs, but you know, in the normal usage of that phrase, pros and cons, I mean, he's very deftly contemplating what's ahead of him and the temperature of the water.
And he was up for being on the album cover. He gave you his permission, didn't he?
Yeah, it took me about 6 months to see him again, man. So I was getting a bit worried about it because I thought I've definitely got to have at least one conversation with the guy. And then I was on my balcony in Sydney. I've been away, but I just caught up with him, you know, around the other side of the bay and had a little chat, and he was quite chuffed to at the thought of being on an album cover. So, and I showed him the shot, and he really loved it too, so it was cool.
Russell Crowe speaking to my colleague Paul Henley about his upcoming gig at Glastonbury. Let's hear another track from his band Indoor Garden Party, Let Your Light Shine. And let's return briefly to our top story. Defiant Joe Biden has told supporters in North Carolina he intends to win November's election, a day after his faltering display in a televised debate raised questions about his candidacy. And in the past hour, former President Trump has been speaking to his supporters at a rally in the state of Virginia. This is what he made of Mr. Biden's performance.
The question every voter should be asking themselves today is not whether Joe Biden can survive a 90-minute debate performance, but whether America can survive four more years of crooked Joe Biden in the White House.
And he criticized his opponent, saying Joe Biden is looking to destroy the country.
We have a man who's grossly incompetent heading up our nation, and he's competing against Putin and President Xi of China and Kim Jong-un of North Korea. He's competing against people that are at the top of their game, and he was never really at the top of his game. He was never very good, but now he's really not good.
That was Donald Trump out on the campaign trail and bringing to an end this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.